The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Space Show. It's great to be here. And hello to everyone in the greater Seattle area listening on KKNW. Let me make a couple of announcements and then on with our program. For those of you who would like to call the show today, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Email is dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com. and thespaceshow@gmail.com, and chat with IMICQ or CompuServe uses the screen name, one word, Space Show Chat. Remember, everybody, we're trademarked and copyrighted. You can download the shows and distribute them any way you see fit. Please don't do anything commercial with them, and no modifications or changes to the text of the interviews. Special thanks, as always, to Andrew over at Gigadial.net, who does our podcasting. We're iTunes compatible, and we're in Podcast Alley and a bunch of other places as well. And you can find the RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast on our website and both of our newsletters. If you do have any issues with our podcast, please get a hold of me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And our website, thespaceshow.com, is there. All of our programs are archived. You can find them there. You can listen to them from the website or download them. If you need instructions in downloading, let me know, and I'll be glad to supply them to you. And also, our comprehensive newsletter is there. It has the details and the bios of everybody during the week, plus the future events. And as I say all the time, if we have to change a show or make some modifications to the schedule, this is where you see it first. And then we have the very short form of the newsletter that you can subscribe to by email. It also is distributed early Monday morning, California time. Send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. We have a store on our website and the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with One Giant Leap Foundation. We definitely need your support to do this show. We thank all of you who have supported us and who are still supporting us despite the tough economic times. We really appreciate it. And again, your support is really needed. A couple of important announcements, and then on to the details for our show. Remember, we're brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, which promotes cooperative solutions for space security. Get more information by visiting their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And we do Twitter, and we do MySpace and Facebook, and boy, sometimes it's a real pain, but we do them all. And the only hold the date I want to call to your attention is the one we're going to talk about today. Mars Society has their big conference this year on the campus of the University of Maryland in College Park, Maryland, and that is July 30th to August 2nd. You can find their website, marssociety.org, and do the online registration, take care of all the business, and you need to be there. So let me tell you about today's show. We actually have two guests, but Chris Carberry is the executive director of the Mars Society, and he is the guest for the first hour. And then we're going to lose him, and Kevin Sloan will be on for the remainder of today's show. And he is director of the Mars Society's University Rover Challenge, which we're going to be updated on. Chris's full bio will be on the website. But prior to becoming the executive director of the Mars Star Society. He was a volunteer involved in space exploration in the advocacy community. He was on the steering committee for the Mars Society and the Space Exploration Alliance, as well as the board of directors for the National Space Society. And for several years, he had been the national political director of the Mars Society. He co-authored Space Language in the 2000 Republican National Platform. And anyway, you can read about him. We're going to start talking to him. Chris, welcome back. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Thank you for having me on again, David.
Always a pleasure to talk about and plan to go to Mars. So,
oh, absolutely.
So are we making progress? What's shaping up for the conference?
Well, are we making progress on getting to Mars or making progress for the conference? Those are two entirely different questions.
Well, the conference helps us get to Mars, doesn't it?
Okay, fair enough. Now, the conference is coming together rather well. We have a really exciting program this year, a little more complex than previous years. But if you, I don't know if you've taken a look at the our website, we have some of the preliminary scheduling out. But very, very busy time, you know. Starting the day before the conference, we're going to be offering tours or having tours of NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, so that should be kind of fun. But then on Thursday, we kind of have this whirlwind day where we'll have, although we don't know who some of our Thursday morning speakers are because we're waiting to see who will be available from NASA since they're still going through this confirmation process, but we'll have a very heavy schedule of policy in the morning, then we're going to do this enormous congressional blitz. Essentially, I think we're probably the only group that will close down their conference for an afternoon, just try to send as many of our conference goers to Capitol Hill as possible to talk to their, we're going to set up meetings for each of the conference goers with their representatives and senators so they can tell them why we need to actually have a bold space program that will send people to Mars as quickly as possible. So we're anticipating about 100 to 150 people will go up to Capitol Hill that afternoon on July 30th. Then we'll come back and have a nice reception and a viewing of Roving Mars, you know, the movie. But we'll also have the director of that, George Butler, on hand to do some commentary, as well as Dr. Steve Squires. So already the Thursday is coming together, but other people we're having, we'll have, we're going to have an art and space program with Michael Carroll and Andy Chaikin will be there, as well as Bert Ulrich from NASA's art program. Other people, we have Jim Garvin coming, Roger Lanius. We're still tentative with John Grunsfeld. We're hoping that'll work out. You know, that'll be kind of fun having him just after the Hubble repair mission. And Miles O'Brien will be there also, running a panel about media in space, which I'm sure is something that would interest you.
Absolutely. In fact, he is. I'm running a panel on media in space for the International Space University July 7th, and Miles is on that panel.
Well, it's coming together really well, so I still, you know, still hope you can come by and maybe take part in that.
Well, it depends on what USC does, as I told you before. You know, the show started. It depends on their class enrollments, and things are different this year given the economy. It's yeah, I think a lot of people and organizations are going to find a lot of changes that they have to make. But we will see. So, you know, I did this, I finally did the California Space Day lobbying. That's the first time I've ever gone to a legislative body. And we were assigned specific members of the California legislature to go talk to. So when you do your lobbying, I've never done it on the federal side, but I would really, really like to do that. Are you assigned to, like I'm from California, would I automatically be assigned to my representatives, or do you just go to anybody you want, or is there a structure to it?
Yeah, there's a structure, and it's a combination of both. Primary goal of it is to assign conference goers to go to their actual representative and at least one of their senators. You know, that all depends on, you know, obviously we need to get the meeting. Usually if you have constituents, you can get the meeting. So obviously be some congressional districts that will have an enormous number of people from, you know, in Maryland and Virginia. So, you know, we'll spread people around. And then other people will actually go to random meetings. We're going to have other meetings with key people in Congress who we think might need a little more attention, you know, to convince them this is something they need to support. But everybody going will be going with a somebody who has experience in doing this as well. It can be very intimidating if it's first time going up to Capitol Hill. So we always assign people in small teams, but with experienced people along with them. So yeah, there's the primary goal is to get people to see their representative, but they will also undoubtedly talk to offices, staffers, or even occasionally one of the members, you know, that from other states or, you know, elsewhere.
Right. By the way, I'm getting a lot of emails that people are having a real difficult time logging onto the Mars Society website and getting to the conference pages to sort of follow on what we're talking about. So I don't know if there's an issue with the website or not, but I do know I've gotten about five emails like that so far.
Well, tell them to email me, and I will make sure, you know, I will make sure we get the process resolved. I've heard that before, and sometimes I have difficulty getting on it. So I will talk to our web people, see if we can get that resolved. But in the meantime, feel free, if you're having problems getting on, email me at Carberry, C-A-R-B-E-R-R-Y, at MarsSociety.org, and I'll make sure you get through the system one way or another. I certainly don't want to lose anybody from coming to the Conference of the Blitz because you can't get on the website.
So who are your keynotes? Take us through some of your big names that you have. I know you're waiting to see what happens with NASA people, but aside from that, who can you tell us is already confirmed and what they may be talking about?
Well, we have, as I said, we have Steve Squires coming, you know, and he'll be giving, that'll be part of the Roving Mars viewing. Let's see, as I said, Miles O'Brien's coming, Jim Garvin will be coming. You know, we're still working out some representation concerning Phoenix and MSL. So we will have discussions concerning both Phoenix mission and the Mars Science Laboratory. Other people coming, let's see, Chris McKay will be there. I'm sorry, I'm just running through my, I never can remember this at the top of my head, so I'm running through my list here. Carolyn Porco is going to be our banquet speaker, so I'm sure she'll be giving some great updates on the Cassini mission. And, you know, as you can see, we often have, it's not only Mars as well. We, obviously, the main primary focus is, but we have some wonderful programming beyond Mars as well. So we'll have the Cassini one Friday morning, you know, the time when we're hoping to have Dr. Grunfeld. I don't know if he can make it then. We also have Dr. Mario Livio from the Space Telescope Institute to talk about the Hubble Space Telescope, and Nobel Prize winner Dr. John Mather. You know, he'll talk about the James Webb Telescope, which will be sent up in a few years. So we actually have some programming specifically on space telescopes as well, which will be kind of fun, particularly right after this really impressive Hubble repair mission. As I also mentioned, we have Roger Lanius, but he'll be part of this program called Exploration. We're going to be having a look at historical exploration on Earth and what lessons we can learn from it. So we're pulling together actually a pretty good panel, which I'm not quite comfortable mentioning everybody on it yet, but we should have a nice wide range of people to be on that, and I'm hoping to get some people from the mainstream historical field and not just, you know, the space people talking about exploration, so we'll have a wider viewpoint of the topic.
So it's really going to be a powerhouse, and then you have your individual sessions like you always do, right?
Yeah, we're making a few changes this year. We'll have, you know, the track speakers, but we're also going to do a lot more of those in a panel format so we can fit more things. As you heard, we have a plenary-rich environment. So when you have so many plenaries, and I haven't mentioned all the ones that might be there, it's hard to fit them all. So we're kind of restructuring things a little bit so we can fit all the plenaries appropriately and still give everybody an appropriate time to speak, and maybe even a more exciting way to speak. You know, being on a panel can actually be a wonderful experience for somebody, you know, being up with number of other people and, you know, really having a great discussion. So we're having that. We're probably going to have a poster session as well, though it's We're still working out the details on that. So,
this is, you know, I would really urge people to, especially if you're in the area, this is got to be the place to be. So the University of Maryland is a pretty big place. Are you spread around the campus? Are you in one building for logistic simplicity? How does it work?
It's going to be. It's not going to be spread all over the place. It'll be in the Student Union Center, I believe. That's the name of it. It says on the website.
So remember,
I should probably get on the website myself. But
I finally got on. Boy, is it something is really weird with it. Unless it's at my end. But then I did get those other emails. But if you remember Ryerson University in Toronto, and some events were a couple of blocks away, and things like that.
Everything is closer. I think there are a couple things that are on different floors, but within the same complex. Yeah, we've had a few of them in the past, which have been difficult. The one in Stanford was.
That was also pretty challenging. You had footprints on the sidewalk directing us where to go. It was really cool.
That's true. But this will be actually more manageable. So everything is in pretty close proximity, so we shouldn't have those problems of people having to run half a mile to get to the next session in 5 minutes.
You have this question from Frank, who is in San Diego, and he said there still is debate and discussion, assuming that we actually go someplace in space. Do we go to the moon or do we go to Mars first? Does the Mars Society have an official position on this, and does it include bypassing the moon, or how do you see the moon-Mars debate?
Well, it's an interesting topic. I mean, we've had a lot of discussion on this, and the Mars Society has never discounted the possibility of going to the moon. What we've always expressed, though, is that Mars should be the target. You know, if we stop on the moon, that's fine, but it should be a stepping stone in the sense that maybe we could test out some hardware and all that, but we can't get stuck there. You know, and that's why we've been, from our start, promoted, you know, building hardware that has as many commonalities as possible, design the mission for Mars, and then do subsets for the moon if you choose to go there. But Mars should always be the focus, whether you go through the moon or you decide to do one of the other paths. And as you alluded to, lots of discussion out there whether we should bypass the moon and go to asteroids or go to Phobos or Deimos or other places. My main goal, and generally as the Mars Society, is to get to Mars in the most efficient fashion, you know, and that could go through the moon. It might go elsewhere. I mean, I'd love to go back to the moon. It's kind of, I find it perplexing that we haven't been there in 40 years, or a little less than 40 years, but since the first time it's been 40 years. So, but we are certainly against doing things like building moon bases and other structures, you know, and multi-decadal efforts prior to going on to Mars. Frankly, I don't think we won't be happy unless we get a really strong commitment to get there as quickly as possible, which means, you know, sometime in the 2020s would be the goal for the Mars Society.
This is a question from June, and June says she's in Boulder, Colorado, and she says, what are the logistics for the University of Maryland? I'm not on your website. I can't get there, but please tell me, are people staying in dorms, or is there a conference official hotel, or is it more on the order of like when you have the conference in Boulder and everybody picks a motel that they want to go to and that are fairly close to the University of Colorado campus?
Interestingly, the answer is both. We actually have a deal for dorms, and you have to make, and if you go on the website under the lodging section on the convention site, you'll notice the way to actually reserve these dorm rooms. And I believe those are like $50 a night or $60 if you have two people. And if you're going to register for those, I believe the deadline for getting the dorm rooms is actually July 1st. So if you're going to do that, you're going to have to think about doing that fairly soon. But we also do some recommendations for local hotels, like the Comfort Inn, and there are a number of others. But the Comfort Inn, I believe, has $89 a night hotel rooms, which is pretty good in that region for hotel rooms.
And they're close to the conference, close to the campus, I assume.
Yeah, they're reasonably. You have to walk across campus, but they're right next to the actual campus.
You have another question from Marshall in Dallas on chat, so let me go back and pick it up. I always hear a lot of talk about exploring Mars, but I've never heard exploration plans for Phobos and Deimos. Are there any presentations or proposals at the conference on exploring the moons of Mars? It seems like a cheap side trip.
You know, I don't know if there are. I don't recall. Actually, I can tell you that no, not thus far. We're still collecting papers, so they could come in. I've heard a lot of people talking about it lately, including some very well-known people. But I wouldn't be surprised if I were to get a paper proposal, a talk proposal in the next few weeks that would actually go over that, since it is a very popular topic these days. So, or if you know anything about it, you're welcome to submit a paper as well.
So the call for papers is still open for the conference?
Still open for a couple more weeks. July 1st, I believe, is the cutoff. Yes, it is. And usually we get the majority of the papers in the last 2 weeks anyway. Everybody needs a deadline, and they wait till last second. So, of course, never know how many we're going to have until like a month before the actual conference.
How do they submit a paper? Where do they send it to?
Oh, complicated questions. They submit it as an email address. I believe it's abstracts@marssociety.org, but let me double-check that. You'd think this would be something I'd know off the top of my head. But
yes.
But why would I know such things?
Because you're the executive director. The buck stops here.
Yeah, I know it, but it sounds good, but, you know.
The reality is, right?
Yeah, what is the reality? Yep, so, hold on one second. Let me pull it up. Well, at any rate, I'll mention it in a second. Why don't we move on?
Okay, and what is the deadline for people who may still want to do this?
July 1st.
So they have to have an abstract?
Or like June 30th, but, you know, before July 1st.
Okay, before July 1st. Okay. Cool. And are you having, when you go to the tracks for the panels, is it one tract or multiple tracks? Or will people be able to see everything that's going on, or do they have to make
hard
choices?
No, there'll be multiple. There's no way possible we can do just one. That's actually one of the reasons why we're doing changing format also. Creating panels instead of, or more panels. There'll still be some individual track speakers, but we're also creating the panels so we're not having so many parallel tracks, because there are always so many great tracks to see and so much programming that, you know, with all these conferences, whether it be ours or ISDC or anywhere else, it's very difficult to see everything you want. Well, it's actually impossible to see everything you want, so we're trying to alter it at least to this degree. So at least people have more of an ability to see what they want.
Okay. And have people already missed the favored pricing on registration, or is there a deadline for that coming up?
I believe they already have. Yes. So the current one, I believe it's $210 for members right now and $270 for non-members.
Okay. This is going to be, I'm looking at your list of speakers, and I really hope my USC thing doesn't happen, because I really want to be there. You have a lot of good programming. This is from George, and George is in Austin, Texas, and he said, does the Mars Society have any interest in what's going on with the Augustine panel? I know that the architecture that is mostly being talked about is for the early stages of what President Bush proposed in the vision for space exploration, the moon. But it would seem to me that whatever happens in these early stages dictates what happens in going to Mars. Are Mars Society groups making any presentations on any plans to the Augustine panel? Do you have any role in this?
We are currently working on plans to make a presentation in front of it. That's in early stages, and I haven't gotten an update from my people on that yet. But we hope to do a presentation in front of the Augustine Committee before one of their meetings. There are several of them coming up. And, yes, we certainly have an interest in what's going on. You know, even though you're right, even though this is the early stages, it's going to have a dramatic impact on what the later stages are going to, how they're going to turn out. If the current launch, the current plans, you know, with the Ares 1 and 5, well, you know, whatever you feel about Ares 1, a lot of the components they're testing on that or using on that, some of them will be, you know, are supposed to be used on the Ares 5. And the Mars Society has definite opinions on the Ares 5 in the sense, at least in the sense that we need a heavy lift vehicle. And Ares 5 is the has the most lift of any of the ones that we've seen. So to get to Mars, we need a heavy lift vehicle. So whether it be the Ares 1, Ares 5, or some other vehicle that somebody can pull out of a hat that's actually going to work and be that will have the ability to actually build in the near future. One of the things we will express to the Augustine Committee, to Congress, the necessity to have heavy lift capability. I mean, and I don't mean, I mean really heavy lift.
Not EELV heavy lift.
Yeah, not EELV. Now, I mean, we're not going to argue against, you know, that's the second thing. You know, even if we went with EELVs, just launch people up, and I'm still not, you know, I still haven't seen two people in a row saying how quickly, you know, could do what some people you talk to would say you could human rate them pretty quickly, and others say it's going to take quite a while.
I think. Oh, I got an email on that today. Hold on.
All right.
Let's see if I didn't delete it already. Because they had presentations. United Launch Authority,
You quote that was at the Augustine Committee that mentioned it might take 7 years.
Yeah, 2013 is what they're predicting. The Aerospace Corp issued a study claiming it would take 5.5. How do they get 5.5? To 7 years to develop the Delta IV option for Orion. I mean, you know, it's across the board, as you're right.
It comes back to the thing that, you know, there are a lot of proposals out there, but nobody knows how quickly any of these things would happen.
Right, and they said also that if you wanted to human rate the Delta IV, that takes longer than human rating the Atlas, and that would be 2014. So we're talking somewhere between 2013 and pick your upper end, 2015, 2014,
yeah, and when you're getting into there, you're thinking, well, why don't we just go with the Ares 1? You know, you can make arguments whether it's going to work appropriately or not.
Hold it there. We're getting our musical break interlude from KKNW in Seattle. Everybody stay where you are, and we'll be back with Chris, I promise, before 2013. 3 minutes, actually. Hold on, everyone.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. This is The Space Show. I'm your host and your founder and Dr. Space, David Livingston. Our guest today, Chris Carberry, is the executive director of the Mars Society, and we're talking Mars, their conference, and much more today. First, I have a quick announcement, which is actually a plea for help. A couple of listeners have bought the new iPhone, okay, and they're trying to figure out how to listen to The Space Show on their iPhone. And I don't have an iPhone, and I have no clue what to tell them would be the best way to do it, nor do I use the AT&T network. So if anyone out there uses an iPhone and knows how to the best way to listen to the show on it, email me instructions so I can share with the listeners, or you can chat it in, and I'll save your chat. Or if you have a question for our guest, you can make that part of your question, but we'd really like to get some input on how to listen to the show on an iPhone, if anybody out there knows that. Okay, now, Chris, do you have an iPhone?
I don't, but I'm actually shopping for one right now, so I'll be interested to hear your instructions.
Well, next year it's supposed to come out on the Verizon 3G network, which is supposed to be a lot better than AT&T, but I don't get plugged by Verizon, so I'll leave that one. People can decide on their own. But I do have a question for you. This is from our friend Brian in Boulder. And can you give us a quick summary on the upcoming FMAR season this July at Devon Island? I've been helping as the mission support director, and I'm very impressed by the people and the projects this year, especially the UAV and the Google Lunar XPRIZE robot. Really cool stuff. Ask Chris to tell us about it.
Oh, yeah, it's a really cool crew. You know, they're coming up to actually just the end of this month for a full month, and they actually should be back. They're scheduled to be back to actually give a presentation the last day of our conference also. But, you know, really strong crew led by Vernon Kramer. Interesting background Vernon has, you know, with a mining engineering background, lots of extreme environment experience. It's been all over the world, I mean, including places like Afghanistan, Korea, Thailand, Indonesia, South America, and, you know, so has a lot of experience in geology and extreme environments, so perfect person to be commanding this mission. You know, other people going, Joe Pelea, how many people know from Four Frontiers Corporation. Also have Stacy Kuzak, who's in the space station training lead at NASA's JSC, where she trains astronauts and cosmonauts in operations of the International Space Station. So, you know, pretty strong crew. Also have a woman named Christine Ferrone, flight controller for the International Space Station at NASA Johnson. So, you know, Brian Shiro, Hawaii, you know, is an earth scientist and, you know, a seismologist by training. So this is an interesting team. Also have Christy Garvin, who is a teacher at elementary school in Georgia. So a strong crew with a varied background, but a very impressive background. We could, you know, actually one of our best crews ever, which is interesting because we were rather late in getting the process moving. You know, we only did the call for volunteers for crews back, I don't remember what month, it was like March, I think. So, which was a ridiculously short turnaround for staging an Arctic mission, but an amazing crew came together in an amazingly short period of time. And this is a very, not only do they have impressive resumes, they, you know, they're really self-motivated as well. They've been just going out and finding their own science projects and sponsorship. You know, it's really quite amazing to see them coming together and doing it really rapidly and being able to find all of these resources, you know, to bring up there and do probably one of our better science missions. They're going to be bringing up equipment to test, to examine, or explore for subsurface water like you'd need to do on Mars. They'll be bringing up an aerial drone to do, you know, exploration, go ahead of their sorties out in the field up on Devon. They'll be bringing a project from MIT, which I have to admit I'm going to have to look up to tell you more details about, and lots of other projects as well. So not only wonderful background, but they have found their own projects to bring. And they are actually bringing all of these projects themselves. None of these are ones that the Mars Society actually proposed for them. They've gone out and found these all themselves, and we'll be bringing them up to the station.
Now, this project goes on yearly, correct?
We took a year off last year, but we had a 4-month mission up there in 2007. Took a year off last year. We're having one this year. We might just do it every 2 years at this period, but we're in analyzing this. There are some possibilities developing for possible ones next year based on some interesting science projects that have been being presented. I can't go into them right now, but it's going to go on a case-by-case basis and what our funding needs are and what we're having to do, but we still intend to run this facility. It's a wonderful facility, and as I said, if we can run a really strong mission this year, it should go a long way to help fuel excitement about it for next few seasons, to show that we're really doing some cutting-edge research that will be useful when we actually go to Mars.
How do people find out about it and apply for it, assuming you do hold it in future years? I know it's too late for this year. But
generally, we send out a call for volunteers. We have, as I said, this one, and that's usually sent to the membership, or at least the email list, which is a broader list of emails than the membership list. So people can either sign up, be on our email list, you can go onto our website and do that, or they can become a member, or just look at our website periodically. We're always having updates of what the newsletters going out say, and other news stories get frequently posted to it. So you can generally get a feel of what's going on and any updates or announcements by just going to the website if you don't get our email newsletter. We also, of course, have another simulated base, the Mars Desert Research Station. We just finished up in the spring a wonderful mission, newly improved kind of format of doing it, and we're going to do another one starting in the fall. So there's another opportunity for people who might want to participate in one of these analog experiences, but they wouldn't have to go if you don't want to actually trek all the way to the Arctic. That one's in the Utah desert near Hanksville, Utah. And the call for volunteers for that should be coming out in the next few weeks. I'll have to talk to Artemis Westenberg, who runs the MDRS program now. I know she's planning on sending out a call for volunteers and crews very soon. So that season should be developing pretty soon, and I know there's some exciting things developing at MDRS as well. We're hoping over the next few years to really shift that facility into more of an education and training facility. We'll still have these wonderful analog missions, for people who volunteer, but we'll also try to give back some of that knowledge and bring in other groups to utilize it and then do training. We're probably going to have a master's class there next year, and perhaps there might be even a workshop on living off the land, utilizing different resources that might be available or could be available on Mars. So we're hoping to really transform that facility as well.
You have a question from Harold by email in Durham, North Carolina. What are the requirements for the Mars Society or for any organization or person to call a site an analog site, or are there no requirements?
Well, there are requirements generally that they have to have similarities to Mars. Obviously, you're not going to match atmospheric pressure and what the chemical nature of the atmosphere is. Obviously, we have a lot more oxygen, nitrogen in our atmosphere, and our Earth's atmosphere obviously is a lot thicker than Mars, but with, say, Hotton Crater, the area around that in on Devon Island, it's an impact crater. It has if you look at the pictures, sometimes if you look at aerial photographs of Devon Island and then look at aerial photographs, at satellite photographs of Mars, sometimes difficult to tell the difference. There are also extreme environments where, trying to figure out practices for finding extremophiles, extreme life, on Devon Island could be very useful for looking for it on Mars. Same thing with the area around Hanksville, Utah. Once again, if you look at the images, lots of similarities, a lot of different similarities in how erosion, you know, if you look at the gullies that develop around the Hab and Hanksville, you know, a lot of similarities. You know, a lot of the processes, of course, aren't going to be the same. You know, they're different planets, but generally, to be an analog, there have to be this sort of similarity, at least particularly in how it looks, and being somewhat remote as well. You wouldn't want to do a Mars analog in the middle of the woods or the jungle, you know.
Well, not if you're normal.
Not if you're normal. You could do that, or you could kind of harken back to the days. Well, Mars used to be a warmer, wetter place. We're doing an analog for what Mars might have been, you know.
You got a couple of other questions. Marshall says, I think it will take at least 200 tons to LEO launcher to set up a Mars mission. Are there presentations on the total mass required for a Mars mission and the minimum launch system needed?
Coming at the conference?
Yeah.
A lot of these things will be discussed. There haven't been any specific, that I recall, tracks that I have seen, but once again, almost all the track papers that I get, that I look at, usually come in the next 2 weeks because the cutoff date, it's kind of terrible when I'm talking even this close to the conference when I can't tell you if that's going to be talked about. It's not, you know, Robert Zubrin, I'm sure, will talk about elements of that in his discussion. There'll be some other people. There are some people I know talking about one-way missions to Mars, and there'll be other variations on that. But that specific talk, I'm sure there'll be actual discussion on that. There always is. But most of my papers won't come until the next 2 weeks because the deadline's coming up. So I should have a much better feel, at least for the other sessions, you know, come the beginning of July. So what I recommend is take a look at our website in a few weeks. We should certainly have more programming information up there. And we'll actually have it listed thematically as well. And that will be easier to find that now because we're going to be doing the panels and other things like that, you know, thematic panels, and we'll list, you know, if there's a particular one on propulsion or on what, you know, sort of mass, amount of mass you need to get into LEO, we'll actually mention that. There probably is going to be enough people talking about that we'll actually have a whole panel on the topic.
Well, maybe Marshall will submit a paper. He's good at this.
Yeah, you're very welcome, too. We'd love you to.
He also says in Russia they're doing a simulation for a 105-day Mars mission, part of the Russian Mars 500 project. I would think that should be present at the Mars Society conference, and there should be some panels or papers on what the Russians are doing with their simulations. Do you know if that's happening?
Yes, actually, on that one, I did receive a paper on that by a gentleman whose name escapes me at the moment, so I apologize, who's somehow associated with the project. So there is at least one discussion. We'll probably make that. That'll probably be an individual talk, not on a panel, unless there are more people concerning it. But there will be discussions on that topic, on that program. It's really interesting. I'm really curious to see that as well and kind of see what the results of that over time are. Interesting project.
He also says ESA is in the planning for a longer 520-day mission, almost 2 years. So, you know, I got a... No, let's see. That was for going to the moon, so forget it. I won't bring that up. Well, it's a group in Sweden that is doing a lunar analog thing, but for a minute I thought they were talking about Mars. You know what's well, here, let me read Kathy's question to you first. Kathy is in Des Moines, Iowa, and she says, there are many members of the new NASA administration as well as the transition team that had connections to the Space Frontier Foundation and to the National Space Society. Was the Mars Society any way connected with the people on the transition team and some of the people who now are involved in fairly high up NASA positions?
Well, we're friends with a lot of them. You know, we met with the transition team. I know George Whitesides. I know Lori Garver. So, you know, the space community is a very small community. Obviously, George was associated with NSS and Lori more with Planetary, and before that, NSS, of course. you know, we know a number of other people, you know, that are coming in as well are already there. So we do have pretty strong ties to a lot of people in these positions, and we do fully intend to talk to them. Of course, we're still waiting around for the new administrator and a deputy administrator to be confirmed, so we're hoping that'll happen soon.
Well, it probably will. I can't imagine that they wouldn't be confirmed. So we'll wait and see. But was anybody a card-carrying member of the Mars Society who now is located up in the NASA upper echelons?
Let's see, upper echelons? Let me think. I know a number of people scattered around headquarters that are, you know, of the older, of the previous, you know, probably don't want to mention this, but the previous
genre,
the previous administrator and one of the previous.
Well, he was on the board, wasn't he?
And Mike Griffin and Scott Horowitz are both founding members, so, you know, we certainly had a lot of connections, but. Of the hierarchy, the new upper hierarchy of NASA, I don't know if any of them are card-carrying members of the Mars Society, but we have great connections with them, though.
Do you have any? I'm just curious. Do you have any members that are actually members of Congress? Do you know if there's any members of Congress that are members of the Mars Society?
Let me think about that. There, I know there have been. You know, we've certainly had conversations about that with them. I don't think any of them currently are, and which is something we do have to remedy. You know, I've been actually going around trying to talk to different types of people to get them, give them membership, have them purchase membership, and I don't believe we actually have any current members of Congress who are members of the Mars Society. That's a good point. We're going to have to work on that.
Are they allowed to join an organization, or is that considered a conflict of interest? Although, my God, you know, why should they steer away from a conflict of interest, right?
Oh, yeah.
This is mild. This is mild compared to what they do. So.
There's no reason why they can't join, or any advocacy group. There are limitations on what I'm sure about what they can do within the group and leadership. Though I don't know all the details there. I know, like, when you're a member, you work at NASA, you know, there are restrictions on what you can do, particularly in an advocacy group that's pretty much promoting your own job. So, they still can be a member. It just, there's some restrictions on whether they can be on, like, the board or something or other committees.
Here's what I recommend. You can be the leader for it, but this means you have to get support with the other space advocacy organizations, which could be a real uphill battle. I don't know. But you need to offer members of Congress the special space advocacy supporter membership. And when they join that for X dollars, whatever it is, they are a member of all of the main organizations, even though some of them have slightly different agendas and programs to go. But they get instead of having to join Planetary and NSS and Mars Society and Space Frontier and all of this separately, they get a blanket membership in all of them, and the organizations, you know, figure out what the price is, and they get some kind of sharing in it. And then these guys in Congress get all of the mail from all of the organizations, and they're gone down as a supporter and a member of all of them, and they have this special congressional one member serves all space advocacy support group.
Not a bad idea. I actually like that idea. I don't know if they necessarily like getting all the literature and all the emails from every space organization.
They'll give it to their staffers. What the hell do they care?
That's true.
The staffers will get it. But, you know, they aren't going to join every organization. You know that. And so it makes Mars Society sort of compete with this one and that one and, you know, whichever. But this way it brings them all together, even though they have somewhat different agendas. But overall, we're all working toward the same spacefaring type of development goals. I think it'd be really cool, and you can lead the way on that for all the other organizations, assuming they'll even listen to you.
Well, we might. You know, as I said, I am on the steering committee of Space Exploration Alliance, a wonderful way to start channeling that. And we're going to be leaving literature for every member of Congress during our blitz, whether we're not going to necessarily meet with everybody, but...
Right, I understand that.
It would be certainly a good opportunity to actually make sure they get something, all of them. So it's not a bad idea. I'd be willing to talk to the other groups about that.
Just remember where you heard it.
I will. I'll always plug you whenever it comes up.
We're coming up at the point where we're going to leave KKNW in just a few minutes and then take a break and come back with Kevin. But let's sum up. And in your words, succinctly, why should people come to the conference this year?
Well, if you want to have an impact, you know, as I said, there's great programming, no question, but very few conferences you're going to be able to actually go up to Capitol Hill and talk to your members of Congress and tell them why this is important, you know. So you can actually have an impact by coming to this conference. Plus, you'll be able to see some wonderful programming, some of the best programming of the year for any conference, I think. So I think, plain and simple, that's the reason, and it's at a key moment in time. With the Augustine Committee, you know, meeting and the new administrator and deputy administrator coming in, all the decisions that are going to be made concerning, or most of them concerning the future of human spaceflight will probably happen this year or next. So really important time to have an impact if you actually have an opportunity to. So that's, above all other reasons, that's a good reason to come to our conference.
And call for papers until June 30th, still available. The website, everybody, is Mars Society, there's two S's there, .org. And you can do all of your registration and everything online. Join the Mars Society for sure. You know, meet the people when you come. Meet Chris, and Dr. Zubrin is going to be there. He's talking several of the presentations, and actually a lot of the people will be there, have been on the space show, so you can meet a lot of people that you've heard about and have heard speaking. Where are you going to be for 2010? Do you know yet?
We got a group of people submitting proposals. We're hoping to make a decision soon. I'm hoping we'll be able to have a decision on the 2010 conference within the next few weeks and be able to announce it, or at least have pre-registration at the conference.
Any you want to tell us the top three or four considerations?
Not at the moment.
Let me just ask you this. Is Boulder back in the running, or you're not going back there for a while?
Boulder's always in the running.
I know
you like Boulder.
I think
we should have it Boulder every year.
Boulder is great. I love Boulder. It really just don't have it back at Stanford or Toronto. Actually, UCLA turned, other than the fact you did it over a holiday weekend.
UCLA was very nice. You're right, but the holiday weekend was problematic.
No, but the facilities were compact and right there, and everything was really easy to work out and deal with, and you could walk down into Westwood for evening entertainment, and it was a great place to have a conference.
Yeah, I'd consider going back there. It was a lot of fun. It's just, we'll do it at a different time. We won't do it over the Labor Day weekend next time.
If people want to get a hold of you, because we're going to get the musical goose in just a minute from KKNW, but if people want to get a hold of you, do you give out your email address, or do you want me to filter email for you?
No, they can email me directly at Carberry, C-A-R-B-E-R-R-Y, at MarsSociety.org. And particularly if you keep having problems with the website, let me know, and we'll make sure we remedy the problem one way or another.
Well, I got on, but it's very, very slow, so and I haven't heard back from anybody else. So, people, you know, again, based on my experience with the California Space Authority and going up to the California Legislature, you really want to go to Congress and lobby and talk space with your representatives and with the Mars Society. This is one of the most rewarding things I have ever done. I didn't think I would ever say that, but it really was, and you'll learn a lot. Even if you think you know how government works, trust me, you'll really see how government works, and you'll either run for cover or you'll jump up and down and cheer the democratic process. I'm not sure, but you need to do it. Chris, thanks. We're going to go to Kevin in just a few minutes, and I hope I see you there, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on again.
And we'll do some more programming together later on, maybe a wrap-up of the conference in the fall.
Oh, that would be great. Great.
Okay. Everybody stay right where you are. Back in about 2 minutes with Kevin Sloan. Thank you all, and next week, back in Seattle.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to The Space Show. This is the section of the program we call the Special Edition. I'm your host, David Livingston, and for this segment, our guest is Kevin Sloan, and he's been on before, and we talk about the Mars Society University Rover Challenge, and he's the director of that program. It's now in its fourth year, right, Kevin?
Yeah, coming up on fourth year,
because the bio I have from you is from last year. It's an annual competition for college teams to design and build the next gen of Mars rovers that will one day work alongside astronauts in the field. Kevin is on the steering committee for the Mars Society, in addition to serving as the director of PR and marketing. And in between his many roles with the Mars Society, he spends his day working as a systems engineer in the Washington, D.C. area. He has degrees in electrical engineering and mechanical engineering from Penn State and is currently pursuing his master's in systems engineering from the University of Maryland. So you're going to be right at home for this conference. You can just go from classroom to the conference, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's right around the corner for me.
Really cool. Okay, you were on before telling us that the University Rover Challenge was about to happen, but it's now happened, right?
Yes, it has happened.
And what happened?
Well, it was at the end of May. It was really another tremendous showing by all the teams. We had, out of the 10 teams that were initially building and intending to compete, we had seven teams that made it out to the field. Probably about 80 or 90 students that were out there with their rovers all competing. And it was really an impressive year this year. I was expecting another close battle like last year. In 2008, the first and second place teams were separated by just a single point. This year, the competitors were all blown out of the water by our neighbors to the north from Canada. York University from Toronto, they ran away with the competition this year.
You guys didn't rig it? Come on.
We didn't rig it. No, I guess you could say I would probably put a few kinks in there, help out some of the American teams. But I figured five American teams going against two international teams, they'd be able to keep the title at home here. But tell you what, York University, they showed the Americans up.
What did they do that was so cool? And do you have videos of this on your website yet?
Well, to answer that second question, as of about an hour ago, yes, we're slowly getting some of our videos up there.
That may be why the...
A few weeks now, but it took us a while to decompress after URC and catch up on sleep and whatnot. But we're finally getting a lot of the video content posted up there.
So I'm looking on your – I'm on the website now, and it has team photos, and then it lists York, BYU, UNR, Oregon State, Georgia Tech, and UCLA. Is that the order in which they came in, or is that just the order of which you put them up on the website?
That, let me pull up the main site there.
And is BYU?
It sounded like the order of finish. The one team that was missing from that list, it sounded like, was, and there's one missing from there. We don't mean to leave out the team from Poland. Warsaw University of Technology was in there as well.
And they came in and won, and they were one of the finishers.
Yeah, they were one of the seven teams that made it out. And I tell you what, if there is a team that deserves the Spirit Award for perseverance in spite of logistics obstacles, it would be the team from Warsaw. Aside from the obvious fact that it is a very long flight from Poland to the U.S., just shipping their rover internationally and dealing with the customs issues was an obstacle in and of itself.
Yeah, I wonder how they got it back to Poland, because they have to go through ITAR to get it back, right?
They went through a series of shipping companies that were working with each other, and I had to work with them, signing all kinds of papers. And the rover got here fine, and it was on, I guess there was a temporary import that they were able to bring it in under and ship it out without too many issues. But they ran some headaches. Their rover didn't even get in until the very last second.
And it worked. Amazing that it survived the trip.
Well, they had to pull an impressive all-nighter. I was there when the rover arrived by a truck that drove the 5 hours down from Salt Lake City. And it's about 10 o'clock at night. It's dark. There's a lightning storm on the horizon. It's just starting to rain. A truck pulls into this small desert town with nothing but one box at the far end of it that contains, go figure, a rover. And as it was unloading in this really surreal scenario, one of the team members from Poland said, "This feels like a cheap sci-fi movie here." With lightning's going off in the background, and the truck driver's asking us, "What's in the box?" "It's our robot."
Amazing. So, York University, BYU, this is Brigham Young, or is this another university?
No, this is Brigham Young, followed by University of Nevada, Reno.
That's what I wanted to know. Okay, and then the rest are self-evident, Oregon State, Georgia Tech, and UCLA.
Yeah.
Who was the judge?
The judges, we had a large team of judges this year. We had special judges Steve McDaniel and Melinda Wales, who are great friends of the organization, and Steve McDaniel has been a longtime friend of the Mars Society. They work with Reactive Surfaces, which is a small startup company, and they were sponsoring some work with extremophile searches throughout the last MDRS season. So they came out as special guest judges to help judge the extremophile search task. We also had Heather Smith, John Baranka, Andrew Duncan, Alex Kirk, Barry Stott, who have all been a number of URC veteran judges in there.
What did the rovers have to do? They all had to do the same thing, right?
Yes, there were four tasks for them spread over 2 days. So each team did one event in the morning, one in the afternoon for both days. We had, on the first day, there was a construction task where teams had to drive up to a panel. This just any simulated equipment panel out in the field where the front surface of it is coming loose, and there are a series of bolts there that have to be secured by the rover. And there were actually two panels, one that was vertical and one that was reclined at a 45-degree angle. Teams had to go up and secure the bolts on that, which was probably the hardest task. There's a lot of difficult dexterity required of the rovers to be able to accomplish this. The second task they had to do, which I mentioned already, was the extremophile search test. We sent the teams with their rovers out into the field, and using only the equipment on the rovers, they had to find out much about the field site as possible, detecting any signs of extremophiles, which are rare and durable life form, and report it back. And after they were out with their rovers in the field, they had a short time period where they were able to analyze the data. But again, putting this in context of supporting human exploration, there's always a need for a quick turnaround with data analysis, so you're not wasting time. So they had a short data analysis period and then had to give a field presentation to the judges on the fly, arguing why a human team should return to the site the next day or the next week and conduct a more thorough EVA there. The second day, we had a site survey task. There were a number of markers out in the field about a mile out from the starting point. Teams had to drive out about half a mile or so, and were able to drive around to multiple points, but then they had to localize these targets, which were 4-inch diameter PVC pipes, and determine the exact GPS coordinates of these. And the fourth task is, without a doubt, my favorite, and I know it's a judge favorite too, and hopefully for the teams, it's the emergency navigation task, which is better known as the astronaut rescue mission. We tell teams that there's a distressed astronaut out in the field, and out in that area of Utah, it is not friendly terrain. Lots of hills, lots of canyons, you name a desert terrain feature, and there's an abundance of it there. So we give them last known coordinates for a distressed astronaut who's actually strayed from that location. And we have one of the MDRS simulated spacesuits laying out in the field. And teams have to carry an emergency canister there as fast as possible. They have about 35 minutes to find the astronaut.
Did you find any snakes or scorpions out there?
I didn't see any, although I heard from one of the other teams they were spending a little time in between events doing some rock climbing, and they mentioned they saw a couple of snakes.
Yeah, I would imagine. This is their time of year.
Yeah.
Larry in Joplin, Missouri, sent in an email. To win, do you have to complete all four tasks, and was it that not all schools completed all four, or is it based on the time to completion?
Well, it's based on the total points, and the judging criteria for each of those, the only one that where time factors into the overall score is on the astronaut rescue. Obviously, safety being the primary focus on this, teams have to get to the astronaut within 25 minutes to receive the full 100 points, and it scales back between 25 and 35 minutes, and after 35 minutes, the astronaut is presumed lost to the field for good. With the construction task, it's based on how many bolts are successfully tightened. And considering that teams are only able to see the panels through the video feedback on board, nobody got a perfect score in the construction task. And actually, York had the most success. They, I believe, had 56 points out of 100, and it dropped off pretty steeply from there. It's a very difficult task. The site survey is based on the accuracy of the marker coordinates that you provide back to the judges. And the extremophile search task, that one is left a little more to the judges. As far as the scoring of that, it's based on how strong of an argument you make, how well the team understands the science. For example, if they start talking about lots of geology and aren't necessarily focused on the extremophiles and the biology end of things, it's clear to the judges that they're not necessarily looking for the right thing. So a lot of that gets factored into the score there. Getting back to the original question, each of the events being worth 100 points, add up the points from all of the events, and the team with the most points wins.
And what do they win? What is the first prize or the grand prize?
Well, York University, they win a check for $1,000, and we're also bringing out several members of their team to the Mars Society convention that Chris Carberry was just talking about down in College Park. So they'll be down and working on setting up their travel right now. We're hoping that they're going to be driving down with their rover. So I'm really excited, hoping that we're going to be able to have their rover driving around the convention for everybody to see and interact with.
Was there a second prize winner, or you just win but you don't get anything?
The team that won second place, they certainly have a little bit of bragging rights, not quite as much as first, but there's only the big prize for the first place team.
So they don't win a lesser amount of money? Or
no, we put it all on the table for first place, really ratchet up the competition, hopefully.
And I'm assuming you're going to do this again next year, correct?
Definitely. The teams really seem to enjoy it. It's great seeing what they're able to accomplish in the span of a year. We're hoping to grow the event a little bit more. I think we're going to be a little bit more aggressive in this coming year with recruiting for teams and try to expand the field a little bit. So, you know, every year I try to promise teams that I'm going to make things harder on them for the next year, not just with the past, but bringing in better and better competition each year.
So for students in school who are interested in next year, do they contact you? What do they do? They just stay glued to the Mars Society website? What's your recommendation?
Oh, really, any of those. I'll throw out my email address right now. It's kevin@marssociety.org. And if teams have any questions, if there are students out there that are interested, if there are high school students that think they might be interested when they go to college, please send me an email, and I'll keep you in touch as best I can. But also, follow the Mars Society site. We have links through there to our Facebook page. We try to get the release out through as many sources as possible so that teams are able to find the information. We'll be releasing the rules for 2010. Generally, we release those either late August or early September is when we release those. But if you read through the rules for 2009, you'll get a pretty good idea of what the 2010 rules will look like.
And is it in the same location?
I'm hoping they were able to keep it at MDRS. It's really a fantastic site to have it at. It's extremely difficult to travel there, which is a bit of a toll for some of the teams. But really the only limiting factor is how big URC gets. I'm hoping that we're able to keep the event down there. Hanksville has certainly been a great town, and a wonderful host of MDRS and URC for the past 3 years.
Now, it's only open for college teams. You can't be in high school and do it, right?
If you're a high school student, we actually allow you to work with a college team. At the moment, you have to be working with a college team in sort of an internship role. I tell you what, if there's a high school team out there that is interested in competing, I would certainly be willing to entertain letting them enter. I feel pretty confident that if a high school team emailed me and said they had a working rover or were well into the planning phase, I would certainly be willing to let them prove what they've got.
Now, what about some of these private groups? Because I went to Cal Poly last year for the Lunar Rover, you know, contest that they had. Nobody
right.
won it. But they had teams that were put together by adults from different corporations and things like that. They weren't necessarily academically oriented. Some were. But it's only for academic teams. It's not for what a group of hobbyists put together and want to go do, correct?
Correct. And it's not to slight the hobbyists. It's the event is it's a big resource drain for those of us that run it, and it really does require a lot of work. And the thing that I want to be certain of is that we're not detracting anything from the students, because the focus of this really is on the student groups and using this as an educational tool. So my immediate concern is that I want to make sure that we're not pulling anything away from them and detracting from the quality of the event for them. I certainly would like to be able to open it up to the hobbyists, but I think as we're looking to grow this year and invite more student teams, 2010 probably isn't going to be the best year to try to take that on. But if there are hobbyist groups out there working on rovers that they think would be great entrants, then get in touch with me. I'll try to get them in touch with the organizers of MDRS. It would be great to have them out at MDRS on a rotation, or depending on some of these groups, if they're interested in coming out and even judging or volunteering, it would be great to have them out.
Question from Marshall again. The real Mars rovers have lasted over 5 years. How well would one of the Mars rovers do at your experiments and your rules. What about the new Larger Mars Science Lab rover? I'm curious, could it do the kind of mission you're having the rovers do?
As far as Mars Science Lab, it could certainly accomplish a good deal of the tasks. Within the constraints that we have set up, it might be a little bit more difficult. Obviously, the size of MSL is considerably larger than any of the rovers at URC, and in fact would be disqualified on its weight alone.
Oh, you have a weight qualification.
We do have a weight qualification for any given event. Rovers can't weigh more than 50 kilograms. We do penalize them if they go over, but there's a hard stop at 75 kilograms, and they're allowed an additional 20 kilograms for various modules that they're allowed to swap out between events. So the size is a big concern. But as far as the capabilities, Mars Science Lab is really designed to be operated when the communication delay is 20 minutes, as is the case between Earth and Mars now. At URC, the rovers are designed to be operated by an astronaut that is inside the habitat, using some of his free time between EVAs to conduct a little bit more field work. So it's a slightly different scenario, but the navigation would certainly be a feasible task, as would the site survey and absolutely the extremophile search task. It's really something that those rovers have been honed in on, is looking for various features at the microscopic level. The construction task would probably be the one where it fails, because none of the rovers have had to worry about securing equipment panels, so I'd be willing to bet they don't have ratchet sets on board.
No, they probably don't.
It's not to say that the brilliant folks at NASA JPL couldn't figure out how to put those on in an afternoon.
Wouldn't that be something if the JPL rovers lost to York University or the school from Poland?
It certainly would be.
I would love to see it.
I would love to see a head-by-head. I think that would really be great.
Why don't you invite JPL to compete, to win the prize?
I'll have to ask them, because there's the third Mars exploration rover that has been used as a test bed. And if come around next May, June, it's not in heavy usage. It'd be nice to bring it out and see how it racks up against these teams.
Well, think of what an attraction draw it would be.
Oh, it certainly would be.
You know, it would, especially if they lost.
Yes, exactly.
But, no, it would, for PR, it would be outrageous.
Absolutely, and I would really love to see the way that it stacks up against some of the other teams. The Mars exploration rovers are designed to operate at relatively slow speeds, the play-it-safe approach.
Right.
You can get a bunch of college students behind the wheel of their rovers. And I know, for example, BYU has a very torque-heavy machine. The astronaut rescue mission, they fell into the same trap that just about every other team did. They followed, there was a small washed-out little riverbed from some recent rains that went down to the left of one hill, and every team went that way thinking that was the way to follow, and it led to a dead end, and York was the only team that was able to work their way out of it without breaking down and work their way around to the right. BYU almost succeeded because of their torque. They looked straight at the hill in front of them and essentially put the pedal to the floor, gunned it straight over the top, bouncing around, flying everywhere, flew over the top, landed successfully on the other side. The only problem was it was such a steep drop-off on the other side that lost communications and the rover stalled out.
Amazing. I think if the university teams knew that JPL was going to be there with their rover, they'd have a big incentive to even do a better job than they do.
Oh, definitely.
They would really want to go head-to-head with JPL. I think it'd be a real hoot to do that.
Oh, definitely. Even gets above the international competition between the Canadians, the Poles, and the Americans.
You know, absolutely. So the pictures are now up on the website so people can see what we've been talking about, right?
Yes, they can.
Okay, and in the best way, I'm just summarizing for people, the best way for academic teams or people interested in putting together a team is to contact you and get going that way. Do these teams have to have a professor or teacher advisor, or can they just be the students?
It can just be the students, and we try to set this up around the students. So it's whatever works best for the team. Some teams work well with an advisor if they find the right advisor, but for some teams they start up just as a group of students. And it, you know, depending on the department they're in, depending on the context they have, it might be a lot harder for them to find an advisor, whereas if they're able to function as a team by themselves, I'm certainly encourage them to do that. So it really puts the management responsibility with the students rather than having an advisor who's going to offload a lot of that management responsibility.
So this is from Ben, and Ben is in New Haven, and he said $1,000 doesn't seem like it would cover even close to the cost of building and operating a rover or the transportation to come to Utah or wherever you have the contest. What does it cost a team, from the best of your knowledge, to build a rover and to get it functioning and to get to the site of the contest?
Well, you're absolutely right that $1,000 barely scratches the tip of the iceberg, which is a credit to these students that, you know, considering the what they're going to get compared to what they've had to spend in resources, they're in it for the spirit of the competition. The student teams, and if you read down into the minutiae of the rules, this year we allowed them $15,000 to spend. And this was both in cash and the equivalent value of any donations. So if somebody donates a fancy laptop that's worth $2,500, that $2,500 counts against the cost of the rover. And this cap doesn't even include the computer equipment that's used at the base station, so it's just for the rover. The travel cost, that varies team to team depending on where they're coming from. BYU has a short drive, so they need a couple of tanks of gas, whereas Poland has international shipping of some serious electronics to worry about. But I tell you what, teams are very resourceful. They really do a tremendous job of putting together their budgets, working with the departments, the various colleges at their schools, to come up with money, reaching out to corporate partners. And that's one of the great things about this competition is the exposure students get to realizing that projects like this are more than just the detailed engineering. There's all the program management and financial management aspects of it that they're getting exposure to.
What do they usually do with the rover after the contest?
That's a good question. I think it varies team to team. Some teams will use their rovers as kind of a baseline to build for next year. Some teams will use it for testing purposes, try to run it into the ground. Some just completely rip them apart and go with the Frankenstein approach for the next year's rover.
So most of these teams come back and compete in the following year?
Yeah, out of the seven teams that were at this year, all but Warsaw competed in 2008.
Okay. And this is a question from June in San Diego. And June says, are there any issues or problems in security taking a rover across line or flying a rover in, or do they have to be trucked in? How do people normally transport their hardware given this post-9/11 climate?
It's extremely difficult.
Even for American teams, it's difficult?
It can be. It's not impossible. Several years ago when I was a student at Penn State, I was on an MDRS rotation where we brought out a rover with us. And essentially, as long as you lay it out very clearly, you tell people up front what's in the box, then the only issue really becomes things like the battery. Batteries are always difficult. We were using a gel cell, and we were able to claim that our rover was a really bizarre experimental robotic wheelchair.
Are you kidding? And they bought that?
The security folks that we were talking with, they knew exactly that they knew that that wasn't the case, but as long as we officially claim that, then they were fine with it. A lot of the teams choose to drive, and you have teams like York who drove out from Toronto. I think that was a 30-hour drive. Georgia Tech drove out from Atlanta. That was 26 or 28 hours. So I think almost every team drove this year, with the exception of Poland, and they had to work with a special international shipping company to arrange that.
And Canada drove the rover across the border.
They did, and actually in 2008, last year, they used a shipping company. They, I can't remember if they drove or flew, but they worked through a logistics company that took care of getting it across the border. There are no problems. And this year, I think they just decided, especially because they brought a large team this year, they just got a couple of vans, drove across the border, didn't have any issues with it. So the biggest thing is, and we provide documentation, so if teams need any form of document, I always try to turn it around as soon as I can. But as long as you declare everything up front, that's the biggest ally you have in weaving through the red tape.
Even the risky stuff, you declare it up front.
Oh, absolutely. The riskier the components you're trying to ship are, the more documentation you need to provide up front, just to declare it and make it known that that's what you have.
Do you know which is more problematic, the U.S. border or the Canadian border?
That's a good question. I'd have to ask the team from York if they encountered any major headaches. Hopefully there weren't any big problems. They didn't mention anything to me.
You're the director of this program. Are you the one who conceived of it, given your engineering background?
I don't know that I was fully responsible for it. I was trying to, as I mentioned before, when I was at Penn State, working with the Penn State chapter of the Mars Society, we were heavily involved in a very similar project, just at Penn State, though, building a rover to work with astronauts in the field. And it was something that at Mars Society conferences, Robert Zubrin was really excited to see students working on it, and he wanted to find a way to get students energized and more teams working on these types of projects. And I think he was the one who really came up with the spark of, hey, let's have a competition for teams to do this. And I was sitting in that steering committee meeting. That was actually the same steering committee meeting I got elected to the committee. And, you know, being one of the new guys, I was dumb enough to raise my hand and say, oh, I'll take that on. I've been running with it ever since.
Here's a question from Joe in Boston, and he says, David has on from time to time people who talk about different nonprofit organizations who sponsor various robotic and engineering challenges as a way to improve STEM education for people. Do you know of any of these organizations? I can't think of them right now, but it would seem to me this would be a good alliance for the Mars Society to team up with and maybe to get more support for what you're doing. It seems to me there's a lot of similarity and the different venues could really work together. I don't recall the names of the organizations that he's talking about, but I have done shows on them where they do build rovers, not necessarily to simulate Mars, but, you know, just to do things. Are you familiar with any of these organizations?
As far as the specific ones that he's referring to, I'm not sure offhand. I know there are tons of these competitions out there, and it's refreshing in the sense that there are so many opportunities out there for students, and I guess it's probably a good thing that there are so many different organizations out there doing this that we almost end up having to compete with each other for teams. So that's probably a positive. But yeah, it's always great to work with those organizations. We try to reach out as much as we can to other groups. I know Chris Carberry has been helping me reach out to a couple of different groups, trying to build partnerships where we can. You know, a lot of it comes down to just the time of it. Everyone's so busy actually running their event, it's hard to spare time to try to coordinate things with other groups. But it's certainly something we try to do. If there are other groups that are interested in working with us on this, you know, we certainly would love that opportunity.
Well, listeners, if you have a kid in college or you know someone, This is a great activity to get them involved in. And the website is marssociety.org, and then look for the link to University Rover Challenge. It may be listed as URC. I don't recall how they did it, but you'll get all of the information there. And when do applications start coming in for 2010? What's the timing on doing this?
Well, I mentioned late summer, generally August or September, is when I release the rules for 2010. And I encourage teams to let me know if they're interested as early as they can in the fall. But then it's not until January or February that we have the official indication of participation deadline. That usually ends up being February 1st is the deadline, I believe.
So pay attention, listeners, and you should join the Mars Society anyway, but you can get the information in a lot of other ways. But what a great activity to get involved in if you're interested in this sort of work. And I would imagine not everybody who does it is from the engineering school. Is that correct?
It's definitely correct. In fact, the teams that are really successful, they need to have a strong understanding of science. And what we've seen so far with the first three iterations of this is no team has been able to win without having a strong understanding of science.
Now,
they really perform well in the science challenges.
So how does that relate to the engineering of getting it to travel and do what it's supposed to do? Where does the science come in on the rover?
Where it really gets interesting is we define science requirements, and the way we set up the science-related tasks with this year, the extremophile search tasks and some of the geology soil analysis tests that we've had previously, we set the requirements up so that really you need to have an understanding of the science to define what the engineering requirements of the system will be. And so from the get-go, you need to be thinking about the end application of what's the best way to perform the science. Where do I need to look to accomplish this? So throughout the entire process, it's not just engineers building a robotic system and then they hire a geology student with the promise of beer to travel out to Utah with them to do the analysis. They really need to be working closely throughout the entire build cycle.
Okay, and your email address again is kevin@marssociety.org for people who want more information for this year as well as for what's going on next year, right?
Yes.
And you will be at the conference, easy to find for those of you who are going to the Mars Society conference. You definitely want to meet with Kevin and talk to him about the University Rover Challenge. What else should we be talking about for the challenge? Have we covered it all, or have I left some important information out?
Well, I think we've really covered a lot of it pretty well. At the convention coming up in late July, early August, I'll be chairing a panel session featuring York, and I know Georgia Tech is planning on coming, and any other teams that are able to make it out, talking about this year's URC and starting to set the stage for next year. So you get to meet a couple of the teams, hopefully be able to see at least one, if not two, of the rovers.
Cool. And great way to spend time and to inspire and motivate your kids. So turn them on to this program if they're at school or they're out and they haven't listened to it. Let them hear about the University Rover Challenge. Maybe they'll get it interested in it with a group at their school. You never know. Kevin, keep me posted as things are moving forward for 2010 so we can tell people what's happening then.
I will do.
And we will do it again. And I hope I can get back to the conference and look forward to meeting you in person.
Excellent. Yeah, and hopefully you'll get a chance to see the York Rover in person.
Absolutely. I'd like to interview the team. Be really cool. I may do that anyway. I'll be in touch with you on that. But maybe some of the team leaders, while they're if I can't get back there, maybe while they're there and we can use a U.S. phone system, we can put some of them on the phone and do a show.
Yeah, that would really be great.
Okay, we will stay in touch. Listeners, that's it for today. And again, I want to thank Kevin Sloan and Chris Carberry. And it's always great to talk about Mars and the Mars Society. Tomorrow, Bob Zimmerman comes back on, everybody's famous space journalist you love to argue with and hate. And he will be telling us more about what's happening in space news. So you don't want to miss that program Tuesday evening. And again, special thanks to Chris Carberry and to Kevin Sloan for today's Space Show program. Bye, everybody.